not. What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
Hello, and welcome to episode 210 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Dr. Mark Graber, a Regents Professor at the University System of Maryland and a Professor of Constitutionalism at the University of Maryland School of Law. Dr. Graber is the former Associate Dean of Research and Faculty Development at University of Maryland and is a former Visiting Professor at the University of Virginia School of Law, University of Oregon School of Law, Harvard, UT Austin, Yale, and Wesleyan. He is the author of 5 books and the editor of 9 books, many of which concern constitutional law. He's an organizer of the annual Constitutional Law Schmooze, and by this point, I hope you gather a trend that he is very interested in constitutional law. Dr. Graber, thanks so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
Doing well. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're welcome. I'm very glad to have you. The first question I'd like to pose to you is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
Well, I am a professor. I like to think of myself as a monk. There are professors who are out there in the world advising campaigns, writing policy papers. I live in universities, so in some sense what I do to advance the public interest is teach students, try to prepare them to understand the constitutional order, try to prepare them to understand constitutional history. I try to do research in constitutional history, which I hope is available in some ways through them for all citizens. But that's the way I sort of work on the public interest, that I think in a society, there's a division of labor, and my labor is teaching the next generation.
So education clearly is your modus operandi for advancing the public interest. Why is it important for anyone to have an understanding of America's constitutional history and constitutionalism in general? How is it relevant in the 21st century, 250 years after this document was written?
Well, the first thing about constitutionalism is, since we are a constitutional democracy, it's rather important to understand what that is, how constitutions work, how they sometimes don't work. It's sort of like if you're going to ride a bicycle, you ought to know what a bicycle is and how it works. So this is the way we are governed. Here's how it works. Here's how it might work better. Here's how it sometimes doesn't work.
So Do you teach first-year law students?
Yes, first and second-year law students.
So students come in fresh out of whatever the economy or undergraduate school or wherever they're coming from. They show up in your class in constitutional law. Hello, I'm Professor Graber. I'm going to be your instructor for the coming year. Then what? Do you have a speech to give them? I mean, maybe some of them were forced to do constitutional. They're more interested in making as much money as possible in mergers and acquisitions. They're in your class. How do you grab them? What do you say to those students when they first walk in?
Well, it varies by the year and by the issue. I think next year I'm going to start with the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776. And the reason why is this is the most radically democratic constitution in the history of the United States. And it turns out the framers hated the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776, and a good deal of American politics is the struggle over the Pennsylvania Constitution as to whether we want something like this on the national level, and to get a sense that many of the issues we're fighting over today are very similar to the issues they fought over, and to understand the American constitutional order, we need to understand why the framers hated the Pennsylvania Constitution, that we're not simply a pure democracy. We have lots of checks and balances, and then we can discuss, well, are these checks and balances good things? Do they make sense? We can go from there.
So just to be clear for our listeners who may be slightly confused, in 1776, there was a constitutional convention in Philadelphia, which is located within the state of Pennsylvania. But of course, the state of Pennsylvania, or at that time, before the Declaration of Independence was declared, the colony of Pennsylvania, eventually it did come to have its own constitution. And now, Mark, you're referring to the constitution of the state of Pennsylvania rather than the constitutional convention for a federal constitution. Is that correct?
That's correct. It is the constitution of the state of Pennsylvania.
And what is it that was so hated by the framers about that state's constitution?
Well, a number of different things. So, for example, all power was in the legislature, in the lower house. No checks and balances. The legislature basically told the governor what to do. The governor had no independent powers for all practical purposes. Very frequent elections. Instead of judicial review, the people would elect a council of censors every 7 years, and they would go over what had happened and say, this was no good, this was good. So it was, for its time, extraordinarily democratic. And
what's the problem with that?
Well, what's interesting is a great many framers said, no, the Pennsylvania Constitution risks tyranny of the majority. What we need is a constitution that promotes a lot more deliberation, has a lot more checks on government power. Pennsylvania, you elected the legislature, and the legislature did what they thought best. Now, it's interesting that you said, that what could be wrong with that? And a great many of my students at first said, yeah, what could be wrong with that? And then we discussed, well, isn't it interesting that the Constitution of the United States doesn't have a lot of the features of the Pennsylvania Constitution, that it slows down legislation. It insists legislation run through a complex gamut. It gives power to judges. And so we can start to discuss, like, why might be this the case? Is this a good thing or a bad thing?
So you said that a very democratic system by the framers was viewed as potentially risking a tyranny of the majority. I guess there are two main points off that. One would be, well, Pennsylvania still exists. Has a tyranny ever come to hold dominion over Pennsylvania? Has the majority ever been successful in suppressing the rights of the minority? And then on the obverse side, you might find that many individuals viewing gridlock in Congress and referring to small contingencies and caucuses in the U.S. Senate as holding, and in the U.S. House holding the whole entire legislative body hostage has potentially been referred to as a tyranny of the minority. So I guess the question is, to what extent has Pennsylvania ever actually endured a tyranny of the majority owing to their actual constitution? And to what extent has the U.S. Congress, has they ever experienced a tyranny of the minority?
Okay. Well, remember, as interest, my job is not to tell the students what's right, but to raise issues. So with respect to Pennsylvania, it turns out a year after we ratified the Constitution, Pennsylvania got rid of their 1776 Constitution and replaced it with a Constitution that looks much more like the Constitution of the United States. So the answer to your question is it never got a test. But here we can ask students, you know, students say, well, of course, we would never get rid of the Constitution of the United States. But to point out, most states get rid of their constitutions. I think Louisiana is like on Constitution 12. So, you know, is that necessarily the best idea in the world, never to get rid of the Constitution? So we start
so
with that.
The number 12, just to interject there, is a very relevant number for us, because I believe that the average lifespan of a constitution around the world is about 12 years. Isn't that correct?
I think you're looking to the Ben Ginsburg. I think Tom Ginsburg. I think Tom had about 17 or 19 years. That's my memory. Now, maybe that's changed.
But who, by the way, was a previous guest on Public Interest Podcast.
When the book first came out, it was either 17 or 19.
Mm-hmm. So 17 or 19 years. Okay, so continue with, you were saying
that
Louisiana has 12.
Yeah, so Louisiana replaces regularly, and, you know, Louisiana politics is not the best in the world, but, you know, most of us would say it's not a horribly corrupt, you know, government. It's no worse than most other states. But then we now talk about, okay, as you said, so we have all these checks and balances, and what happens? It's very difficult to have an election that means something. So maybe the first thing to talk about is, well, what's the point of these things, and is it good or bad to get students off the high school civics that if it's constitutional, it's got to be good?
So you're trying to inspire analytical thinking, whereas something can be legal and wrong. For instance,
yeah.
Many individuals would think that slavery, formerly legal, would not be right, or that denying women or Jews or blacks or any number of anyone other than white, wealthy, landowning Christian men the right to vote would be wrong. And of course, but that would have been legal at different points in American history. So you're inspiring students to think critically about the Constitution?
Yeah. So I mean, to take the classic, obviously, is the Electoral College, you know, which may not make much sense, but we'd all agree it's constitutional.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk about the Electoral College for a minute? I know that's an issue on which you have quite some expertise. You have previously enumerated multiple reasons for why it no longer makes sense to have, but you've also articulated reasons as to why it came to be and why it persists as a feature of our democracy. Can you elaborate on what the Electoral College is, how come we still have it, and why it was originally in place, and why we should get rid of it?
Well, with respect to the Electoral College, it's like a great many constitutional practices, unsurprising for a constitution ratified at the time it was ratified, which is it was a response to particular problems in the late 18th century. So one interesting feature is nobody thought after George Washington the Electoral College would matter much. The general assumption was that, in fact, all elections are going to go to the House and Senate, that we never anticipated a two-party system where, in fact, the Electoral College determines the winner. So we can go through the Electoral College has a role for slavery. It has a role for protecting certain kinds of small states, and it doesn't really function anymore. Right now, one of the things the Electoral College does is it means that in national elections, nobody ever shows up to most major cities because most major cities are located in states where we all know who's going to win. Everybody camps out in Florida, New Hampshire, Ohio, West Virginia, etc. And that may not be the best way of running an election. I think the reason it sticks is first that convincing Americans to change anything in the Constitution is foolish. And the other more legitimate reason is while most people agree the Electoral College was wrong, I would not want Republicans to make the rules for electing the president because they'd be biased towards Republicans. Republicans would not want Democrats to make the rules for electing the president because they'd be biased towards Democrats. So we wound up sort of with the rule we have as sort of a default mechanism.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that Electoral College, well, of course, you said that when the country was first founded, the founders anticipated that elections would be determined by the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate. Of course, at that time, the Senate was elected by state legislatures instead of by direct election of the people. So why is it – so they said – could you elaborate on that originally
– the idea is very simple, namely that outside of George Washington, there was no other person they anticipated
mm-hmm.
having a real national following. So what they thought is we'd have five or six sectional candidates, and the Electoral College would choose between them. Senate would choose between them.
Interesting. So that you would think that the elected officials would represent.
In the case of the president, the House of Representatives, I'm sorry.
Right, the House of Representatives. Okay. You also mentioned that there was actually the hurried admission of particular states in the mid-19th century to the Union preceding an election in order to grant extra extra weight to to anti-slavery factions. Could you elaborate on how the Electoral College came to, I guess, influence electoral politics and the addition of states?
Anti-slavery factions, because where this comes from is rather the late 19th century, namely Republicans, to preserve their power. One of the things they begun to do was admit Western states with very low population. So one of my favorite things I always like to tell students is, I know my students and you and the audience probably spend nights pondering, why is there a North Dakota and a South Dakota? You know, why not just Dakota? It's not like the states were just so many people, you had to divide them. The answer is, if there's one state called Dakota, that's two Republican senators and three electoral votes for Republicans. But if it's North Dakota and South Dakota, that's four Republican senators and six electoral votes for Republicans. So Colorado was rushed through before the 1876 election. Colorado's three electoral votes were cast for Rutherford Hayes. If Rutherford Hayes doesn't get the Colorado vote, he loses the election.
So what would it take to get rid of the Electoral College? Would there need to be a constitutional convention, a constitutional amendment? Is there another, or is there another way to get rid of the Electoral College system?
I think the most likely way, if we get rid of the Electoral College, will be some party wins a very, very decisive majority and then starts to, you know, amend the Constitution in its own image. In particular, I think if Democrats took over, Democrats would try to get rid of it, because right now the Electoral College appears to have somewhat Republican bias. That's my best guess.
And that's because in recent elections in the federal level for president, you've seen that Hillary Clinton got more Trumps and more votes than Donald Trump. You saw Al Gore get more votes than George W. Bush. So I guess you've seen multiple elections that could have gone to the Democrats and went to the Republicans, because the Electoral College majority votes was different than the candidate who won the most popular votes.
Yeah, Democrats rack up big majorities in cities, but, you know, in some sense they're overly big majorities. They don't need every vote they get in New York. Where Democrats are weaker is in underpopulated states like Wyoming, and the Electoral College exaggerates the importance of states like Wyoming.
So, Mark, I'd like to transition to you and your personal story. How is it that you became so incredibly fascinated with the American Constitution and constitutional law?
Part of it is simply, as anyone listening to this podcast who knew me as a seven-year-old, I always loved history. So if you go to my ancestral estate, I don't know what other people have on their, you know, their walls when they were a kid. I used to collect, you know, these old documents. They look at in museums. They're fake old documents. You know, they look crumbled. They look like they were 100 years ago. In fact, they were manufactured 7 minutes ago. But I just loved history. I love the history of the United States. I love trying to figure out, you know, what has worked historically, what is not, what moves history. It's just, you know, I've been very, very fortunate. Some people have to work at a job just because they need money. I work at a job I love. You know, don't tell my boss, I'll do it for free.
It sounds like when you talk about what moves history, the common theme is the desire to retain power. Would you care to comment on that?
Well, that's part, but while there are some people, and I think Donald Trump is a good example of this at the risk of doing some modern things, who like power for its own sake, a great many people want power because they're genuinely interested in doing something they believe is good. So Republicans in 1860 wanted power, but they wanted power to stop the spread of slavery, not because they could. Abraham Lincoln wanted to say, look at me, I'm president.
Mm-hmm. So they wanted to control the U.S. Congress in order to stop the spread of slavery. So even though it wasn't potentially the most, I guess, honorable of motivations to admit a state as quickly as possible and divide Dakota into two states, potentially unnecessarily. They did so under a noble banner, and for them, that was justified?
In part, yeah. I mean, in part, Thomas Friedman has a column in Today's Times where he basically tells the left, get rid, you know, lose your fear of power, because if you want to defeat Trump, that means gaining power.
So you've studied constitutions. You're intimately familiar with our Constitution, viewed as a national expert on the American Constitution. What is it about the Constitution that needs changing, or that we ought to prevent from changing, that others are clamoring for change? What would you like to see? The Equal Rights Amendment pass? Do you have, there have been ideas for a balanced budget amendment? What do you suppose would most benefit the American people in terms of changing or preserving the American Constitution?
In one sense, I have a very good friend, Sandy Levinson, as you may know, is championing we need an entirely new constitution. I'm not sure. What I think right now is less reform in the constitutional text, but we have a people in the 21st century that lack basic political information. We have, you know, climate change is real. We've got people who deny it, that it's very difficult to get people to believe, you know, potentially bad news. And to some extent, I'm left with changing the Constitution and to figure out how can we get a democratic citizenry with the capacities to govern a 21st century polity. I think this is a serious problem, one which I don't have a really good solution to. I wish I did.
And as an educator seeking to create a more informed citizenry who's more engaged, if you don't have the answers, who does?
Yeah, I don't know. I like to tell, you know, students, I'm for what I actually argue for is evidence-based politics. The evidence may support lots of different positions, but there actually are some positions the evidence rules out.
Mm-hmm. So we are, I guess, approaching the end of this podcast. Before I ask you a final question, I would just like to throw in there that it is the mission and intention of Public Interest Podcast to create a more informed and engaged citizenry who take greater ownership and feel as though they have greater agency in the direction of their own communities, including through formal political processes and by acculturating ourselves to individuals with different opinions on Public Interest Podcasts. I hope that we can have more civil discourse with those with whom we disagree and view public service as more diverse and more honorable than perhaps is currently viewed. So hopefully this podcast will serve to advance that interest, which you just articulated as being one worthy of pursuit.
We certainly wish you luck.
Thank you. And to our listeners, please help us by listening more and doing more. But a final question for you, Mark. So you've worked in a variety of very prestigious ivory tower locales. You've worked in the Ivy Leagues. You've worked in prestigious state universities. You've become an expert on constitutionalism. You mentioned that you love history. I'd like to ask you to speak about why it's so important why you've done what you've done. Of course, you enjoy history, but there are other people who enjoy history who aren't dedicating themselves to informing the next generation about the ins and outs of our Constitution. Why are you giving so much of yourself to advance the public interest, and what do you hope will be the effect or your legacy at the end of your career?
Well, it's sort of, I want to say, you know, what someone wants to hear said at the funeral is, oh, my God, he's breathing. So I don't like to imagine the end of my career in this sense. But I think where I've given time to it is it's a fascination that I want to share, that I think American history has great potential for good, some potential for evil, and that the best we can hope in politics is people make informed decisions, that they understand that they're not isolated specks, that their country has a history. They have a history that they have obligations to, I think, both preserve and better. And the only way to teach people how to preserve and better their history is to teach them the history.
And that has been Dr. Mark Graber, Regents Professor at the University of Maryland, Professor of Constitutionalism at Maryland School of Law, a former professor many different institutions, former associate dean, author of many books, and editor of even more books about constitutionalism, and the organizer of an annual constitutional law schmooze. And it's not snooze, it's a constitutional law schmooze. So this will keep you going. He articulates his interest in advancing the public interest within the context of education. He seeks to create an informed citizenry that is engaged, that is fascinated with our history, that takes ownership of our history, and understands that we have an obligation not only to learn and observe our history, but to improve upon where we have already been. He mentions many things. He mentions the possibility that a constitutional amendment might improve our nation if that amendment is to abolish the Electoral College and lead to a direct popular election of the United States president. He mentions a need to institute other reforms, perhaps in the Constitution, without throwing the whole thing away, as potentially one of his colleagues would recommend. He speaks about a long history of partisan antagonism and machinations, which sometimes are used for better and sometimes for worse, but in either case, politics has been omnipresent throughout America's history. And ultimately, his fascination with the Constitution is meant to potentially advance the public interest by sparking similar interest in our constitutional structure and history in others. So, Mark, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
This has been another episode of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. I'll remind you to subscribe on publicinterestpodcast.com and on iTunes. Leave a review of this podcast on iTunes and listen on Stitcher, SoundCloud, CastBox, Blueberry, Player FM, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube. Should you wish to comment on this episode, you're welcome to leave a voicemail at 240-630-0380. And the first 3 minutes of that voicemail may be played in future episodes of Public Interest Podcast. Should you wish to support the podcast, you're welcome to leave a contribution in an amount that you feel comfortable with at publicinterestpodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.